Brock versus the United States. Mr. Novak?
May it please the Court, Jason Novak for the appellant, David Brock. Your Honors, this is actually a very opportune time for me to be in this courtroom on this case. Just 2 days ago, the Supreme Court in Herring versus the United States reaffirmed the principle that the exclusionary rule is triggered when its application is served to deter deliberate, reckless, or grossly negligent conduct. Because the officer's conduct, as alleged in Reginald Gotze's declaration, easily rises to that level, the exclusionary rule should be applied to suppress the evidence seized in 3381 Payton.
But there's nothing in Herring. A, there's nothing in Herring, though, about the Stone versus Powell problem. And B, the other thing Herring says, I thought quite strongly, is that the exclusionary rule should be invoked only when its deterrent purposes can be achieved, and that kind of takes you back to Stone versus Powell in a sense. You know, why should we think that this thing that which exacts a price on the truth-finding function should apply in collateral attacks?
Well, I could address Stone v. Powell first, Your Honor. First, if we hold that Stone v. Powell does not explicitly prevent a 2255 petitioner from review here, but for the sake of argument, conceding for the fact that perhaps it does. We still believe,
as this court has held,
we still believe that a central premise of Stone, Your Honor, is that Mr. Brock is afforded a fair and full opportunity to litigate his claim.
Right.
The simple fact of the matter is Reginald Gotze's declaration, which was not obtained until nearly 4 years after Mr. Brock was convicted, details egregious deliberate behavior. And the fact of the matter is, Your Honor, we have never heard Mr. Gotze's side of the case. This affidavit was signed under oath, under penalty of perjury, and the allegations set forth therein completely contradict the officer's testimony in this case. It's because of these findings, Your Honor, that the first step here needs to be an evidentiary hearing. We have this credibility contest now between Mr. Gotze and the officers, and we can't reconcile those disparities until we sit down in the courtroom, have Mr. Gotze testify, and hear what he has to say.
Even if that credibility contest were resolved in Mr. Gotze's favor, the police, though, did have a warrant to search 3375
Correct.
Payton Street or Avenue, whatever it is.
Correct.
And they found evidence that pointed to 3381. And so one of the government's alternative arguments is essentially the independent source rule. You know, let's look and see whether any of this mattered in the end.
Well, Your Honor, we take issue with their application of the independent source rule. It needs to be emphasized that a careful review of Officer Miller's affidavit, the overwhelming majority of the facts set forth therein, was information actually obtained from Gotze.
Right. No,
the vast majority, almost the entire affidavit.
Right. So if we excise confidential informant or something, but yes, it's Gotze.
Right. So if we excise Gotze's testimony, we're not left with very much. In fact, we're probably left with some boilerplate Officer Miller language about his experience as an officer, which, if you look closely, references the fact that his experience has shown him that the house next door may be a stash house. But that's also something we learned from Gotze.
I thought they found at least one piece of paper in 3375 that pointed to the next door house.
They did, Your Honor.
Wouldn't they then have taken that and tried to get a warrant?
Well, we don't know. If you look at that piece of paper, the bill as referenced in Officer Miller's affidavit was from about 15 months prior to this search of 3381. I can think of a whole host of reasons why that utility bill with a different address wouldn't be Mr. Brock's residence. He could have moved. The mail could have been sent to a wrong address. The simple fact, if you take away Gotze's testimony, you take away Officer Miller's experience, we're left with the utility bill. Whether or not that would have been sufficient for probable cause of the second search, I think is a debatable issue. Your Honor, to address another argument from the government also argues at length in their brief that Mr. Brock cannot overcome an alleged procedural default in this matter. And we take issue with that just as we take issue with their application of the independent source doctrine. It must be remembered that this court, in previously holding that the dog sniff outside Mr. Brock's locked bedroom door inside 3381 did not constitute a search within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. The critical to this court's holding was the fact that officers were present inside of 3381 with consent from Godsey. Godsey's declaration clearly cast doubt over that. Godsey could not be found. He was obtained by officers a short time after this search. He fled. The government couldn't find him.
And there's no evidence in the record that Mr. Brock is in any way responsible for the fact that Godsey vanishes.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And ultimately, granted, it took 4 years with the assistance of Mr. Brock's brother and an investigator, but ultimately it was Brock who found Mr. Godsey. The government didn't list Godsey as a witness. They've admitted in their briefing that he couldn't be found at the suppression hearing or at trial. So to somehow now fault Brock, a man who was incarcerated at the time, for his failure to find a fleeing felon, to me just is implausible and it doesn't make very much sense.
I guess there are finality concerns here, though, which actually takes us back to how strictly should we enforce the Stone versus Powell rule and the like, because here we have a conviction of Mr. Brock. There is, if you will, some evidence in the record that there was consent to the search. That's how the police officers testified. So is the existence of potentially future found impeaching evidence enough to unravel on collateral review a conviction that's based on a credibility? If there hadn't been a finding that the police officers were telling the truth, there would have been a different outcome even the first time around. And we kind of allude to that in a footnote in our
right opinion. Well, certainly in this case, Your Honor, and while we understand that finality is always a concern, there also needs to be an appreciation that in this particular case, we had never heard from Godsey. He's not recanting. He didn't testify under oath and then 4 years later say, oh, you know what, I didn't mean any of that. Let me take that back. We've never heard his story. So the first step here is, while finality is always a concern, this is information that goes to the heart of Mr. Brock's constitutional claims. Mr. Godsey hasn't been heard to this issue. If, in fact, his declaration is accurate, it casts a doubt over every subsequent search of 3381. And for those reasons, Your Honor, while finality is a concern, there needs to also be an appreciation that there are some severe allegations of Fourth Amendment violations here. And if we counterbalance those two, certainly we feel as though those trump the finality concerns the court may have. One last point, Your Honor. It just needs to be remembered that while there are certain exceptions here, the Leon good faith exception, if we do believe the allegations as set forth in Godsey's declaration, there is nothing good faith here. And with understanding the principles of Stone v. Powell, there still needs to be a concern, ultimately, that this sort of behavior is going to be checked. If the court or the case law continues to sort of chip away at the exclusionary rule to where we're left where this sort of deliberate, reckless conduct isn't checked, it sends a message to officers that, hey, the next time I need consent to get into a home, what prevents me from putting a gun to somebody's head if they're not agreeing to my wishes? It's just, this is a very, very important case. It can be distinguished from the vast majority of the cases set forth by the government.
But there's no indication here that the officers did that with a wink and a nod with Godsey, you know, putting the gun to the head, getting the consent, and then saying, we're going to turn our heads away while you flee. I mean, they didn't, as far as I know, want him to flee.
Right. No. Yeah. By no means, Your Honor, are we alleging that the government the government did have him in their possession. So ultimately, the government should bear the brunt of the blame to the fact that Godsey wasn't available. But
okay.
I see I'm in my rebuttal time.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Snow. Ms. Rayo.
May it please the Court. My name is Sangeeta Rao. I'm with the Criminal Appellate Section at the Department of Justice, and I represent the United States. Turning first to the threshold question of whether Stone applies, just briefly, this Court should join the three other circuits that have clearly held that Stone applies to Section 2255 proceedings. The reasoning of Stone fully applies to federal prisoners just as it does to state prisoners.
Except all of the stuff about comedy that the Court spent half of Stone versus Powell writing about.
Well, really, Stone doesn't mention Hamidi that much. It mentions it in a footnote and in the text of the opinion, but mostly Stone is about the deterrence rationale and whether the calculus, whether the deterrence effects of allowing Fourth Amendment challenges on collateral review outweigh the social costs. And
well,
again,
but
in Herring,
they also, I mean, the court. No, I think that the theme of not being appellate courts over the state courts is a very important one of Stone. I mean, I agree with you. They talk about deterrence as well, but what about the full and fair hearing requirement, though, when an essential witness, through neither the fault of the government nor the fault of the defendant, perhaps slightly an opportunity that the government let pass, completely undermines? I mean, how can you be expected to litigate that up front?
The full and fair opportunity requirement goes back and is founded on the deterrence rationale. It's not some platonic ideal.
And don't we want to deter officers from coercing consent? I mean,
The question, again, is the calculus, whether you need that kind of deterrence on collateral review.
And what if we are stipulating facts that absolutely could not have been found at the time of the original trial or even the original appeal, and thus it's collateral review or nothing in this case. Either let's suppose the facts in the ugliest possible guise that Mr. Godsey is assuming. What we would be saying in this instance is we want to encourage the police, or at least not deter them, to abuse people to get that kind of consent. Don't we want to deter that?
The question is on a systemic level, whether
one of these cases where you can't find the evidence, it will always be like that. So, yes, it's level.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Compare, though, to the social cost. The social cost of allowing frivolous challenges to go forward, allowing challenges of defendants to and then letting them cast their Fourth Amendment claims as perjury opens the floodgates. They can always cast their.
So the district court has a hearing in this case to see if Godsey's who are they going to believe? Godsey's account of this encounter or the police officer? I would suggest to you that the vast majority of them get resolved at that stage.
Which takes up resources, Your Honor.
Yeah, no, we know that. That's what we're here for. I mean, we're not really here to just clean the federal courts of all casework.
But the question is whether when you weigh both costs, the incremental deterrent effects versus the huge social costs, what's the calculus? And
how do you know how they weigh? How do you know that the deterrence is incremental and social cost is huge? Do you have any empirical evidence of this?
Not empirical evidence, Your Honor, but in Stone, the court did make the calculus. The court said that, in general, as long as there's been a full and fair opportunity, meaning the court system has taken the Fourth Amendment concern seriously, then the calculus weighs on the side of that there is no significant incremental deterrent effect, significant enough to outweigh the social costs. They acknowledge that in an isolated case, there might be some minimal additional deterrence.
And they also acknowledge that there are going to be a few cases where that necessary full and fair opportunity did not occur. And actually, that's the interesting thing. This is a case, you know, where this person is, by hypothesis, completely unavailable. There can be many other cases where somebody wants to file a Fourth Amendment claim in a 2255 or a 2254. I don't see, I'm not going to worry about the difference. That it's obvious that the witness was known to the person or what have you, and you say, I'm sorry, you had your chance. Too bad for you if you didn't do it.
Well, that's right, Your Honor, because the
But not this case. These facts are not that case.
But the full and fair opportunity requirement is premised on the court system taking the Fourth Amendment challenge seriously.
There are cases where, in a particular instance, there is no full and fair opportunity on the facts of a particular case. You don't have to find that the state courts have shut down their courts before you can say there was no full and fair opportunity. If there's a state rule that precludes even going into something, if there's ineffective assistance of counsel in a particular case. There are case-specific applications.
Yes, there are case-specific applications, but again, because of what it says about the court systems taking the Fourth Amendment challenges seriously, it's never about just error correction, and this court has held that in cases like Cabrera versus Hensley, Turrentine versus Miller.
I understand that, but why do you think this is just about error correction as opposed to deterrence of abusive Nazi-style police tactics?
The question, again, is whether the incremental deterrence outweighs the social cost. We agree that there would be some. It's something this court has to decide.
That's just a phrase. I don't understand what we're supposed to get from that.
It's what this court definitely has to decide, but we would submit that that there's not going to be a significant amount of police perjury that wouldn't already be deterred by the risk of suppression at trial, on direct review, during the three-year period when a new trial motion could be advanced. There's also other disincentives, like Bivens actions, like criminal charges against police officers who commit perjury or obstruction of justice. There are other disincentives to that kind of egregious police misconduct. It doesn't have to be through the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment and the exclusionary rule is not the exclusionary rule is not a personal constitutional right of the defendant. It's there for the deterrence effects for society's benefit.
So you're recommending that Mr. Brock should file a 1983, well, actually, either a Bivens or a 1983 action against these police officers so he can get a hearing on whether Godsey's telling the truth and get personal damages from them.
If he had a legitimate claim, he's free to try to do that. There might be other barriers to that, like having failed to diligently investigate this claim.
What's not diligent about somebody who's disappeared that the government itself many times in the record says can't be found?
The government said
Mr. Brock has more resources than the government?
The government said at trial during a missing witness instruction that he couldn't be found at trial. It does make the statement after the officers interviewed him, he can't be found, in the context of saying that he couldn't be found at trial. That's all the defendant has. The defense counsel at that same hearing, all the defense counsel said is, we haven't had contact with him. There's no representation in the record that they tried to find him and couldn't. Even if the government couldn't find him, it's very possible that Brock's acquaintances and friends could have found him. He's hiding from the government.
That's a silly argument, actually. I think that if the government wants to find somebody, they find them.
There at least, Your Honor, needs to have been an assertion by Brock in the record that he did try to find the defendant, tried to find Godsey and couldn't find him. That would have overcome the arguments the government's making, but there's no assertion in the record. He didn't file a declaration along with his 2255 motion, even making that claim. He needs to show that he tried to find Godsey by the time of the suppression hearing. Otherwise, under Rule 12 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, he's defaulted his claim. He hasn't made that showing, and therefore he hasn't shown due diligence, and his claims are most likely wiped out on that basis alone. That applies both to whether Stone would apply and to the procedural default argument. The other aspect, there's two separate bars. One is Stone, two separate procedural bars. One is Stone, the other is procedural default. He's unable to meet either prong of the procedural default bar. He's unable to establish cause for the reasons we just explained. There's nothing in the record, and he could have established it if he wanted to. He could have submitted a declaration saying that he tried to find Godsey and couldn't, but if you search the record as it is right now, you cannot find that assertion from Brock. But he's also unable to make the prejudice prong.
Now, you are actually handling this as though there had been a full trial on all of this, as opposed to simply the district court reading the text of his motion under 2255 to see if he can go forward. I mean, I find it very interesting that you're saying his assertion that he couldn't find Godsey beforehand is somehow at that preliminary stage not enough. Certainly, if there had been a full trial and he failed to come forward with evidence, definitely he
hasn't
have the
made
burden.
The assertion, Your Honor. He's never made the assertion that
he said Godsey was unavailable.
He didn't say that he was unavailable at the suppression hearing, at the time of the suppression hearing. There's nothing like that in the record. There's no affidavit from Brock. There's some assertions in the reply brief, but there's a lot of ambiguity in the defendant's briefs, both the opening brief and the reply brief. Sometimes they talk about trial, and then sometimes they stick in the word suppression hearing. But this court really needs to focus on the time of the suppression hearing. Did Brock make any efforts to investigate his claim by the time of the suppression hearing? And there's no evidence in this record that he did so. Going to the prejudice prong, there's two parts of the independent source doctrine. One is that there was sufficient evidence to establish probable cause without the untainted information. And construing the taint very broadly, taking all the facts related to Godsey away, there's still three substantial facts that would justify the search warrant, and that's that the fact that the federal search warrant was executed at the house next door, 3375, and a large quantity of drugs and numerous firearms were found that morning. And the second fact is that the utility bill shows that Brock controlled the house next door, and the third fact is that the expert opinion of Officer Miller that stash houses are common among drug dealers, and it's the proximity of the two. It's not even just a house in another town across the neighborhood. It's next door. It makes sense that next door, if the defendant is exercising control over the house next door, the drugs and guns are likely to be found there, just as they were at 3375 Peyton. And I see my time is up.
Ms. Rao, can you just tell me for the record, because I can't tell. He proceeded to trial after the motion to suppress, and you make a point about diligence. Did that trial follow immediately upon the heels of the motion?
The suppression motion was filed in April, I believe. I'm sorry, the motion, I think, was filed in August. I do have the dates here. The search was April 9th, 2002. The suppression motion was August 16th, 2002, 4 months later. The hearing was October 18th, 4 months later. And the trial date was two months later on February 26th, 2003.
Thank you. Mr. Novak?
If I may just very briefly address some of the issues raised by the government. As to full and fair, while that issue has given this court great consternation, at the very least, we can agree that it's the right to present one's case. And until Gotsi's declaration came to light, it's just simply that the fact that Mr. Brock has never had that opportunity. We didn't know what Mr. Gotsi had to say to this issue. Now we do. As to the government's position that there will only be some incremental deterrence effect here, we take great issue with that. We think there's great deterrence effect here. If this type of police behavior and conduct, this is precisely the type of conduct that Stone v. Powell was initially concerned with. This is deliberate, it's reckless, it's certainly grossly negligent, and as a result, if we weigh the balances, effect and cost, we think the deterrence effect here greatly, greatly outweighs those costs. Finally, this is not mere error correction. The exclusionary rule needs to serve a purpose. And it's in situations like this where we have a man under oath with a sworn declaration outlining these types of abuses. At the very least, Mr. Brock should be entitled to an evidentiary hearing to resolve this credibility contest. So in sum, we just ask that the court vacate Mr. Brock's sentence or, in the alternative, reverse the district court and order that an evidentiary hearing be held. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Novak. Thank you, Ms. Rao. I want to add additional thanks to the court, Snovak, you and the firm and your co-counsel for accepting this appointment and ably representing the petitioner. The case is taken under advisement.